percussionist Poncho Sanchez with his arrangement of Tintindale, one of the Afro-Cuban jazz classics by conguero Chano Pozo and Dizzy Gillespie. You may recall Manteca being a really popular collaboration, but here Poncho Sanchez pays homage to that collaboration by pairing up with Terry Blanchard on trumpet. We'll hear him later on. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Monday, March the 25th, and today I'm asking the question, what else has to happen before folks decide that we have had enough of this president's insults and contempt of the black community? On the same day that President Obama was on his way, he was pretty close to landing in Israel, his hometown, the city of Chicago, announced that it was closing 54 public schools, allegedly to contain costs over the next 10 years. 54 schools and 61 school buildings. And they're trying to save, Obama's former chief of staff, who is now the mayor of the city, Rahm Emanuel, says that over 10 years, they will try to recoup from the $1 billion deficit they now have. Now, they've posited any number of reasons why this is important: to contain costs, you close a school. So you close 54 schools this year in Chicago, but there are 129 that are targeted. And since 2001, 100 schools in Chicago have been closed. And almost all of them are in the black community and Latino community. And what is going on in Chicago is typical of what's going on in many major cities. Detroit. Detroit has closed 130 schools since 2005. Imagine that, more than 130 schools. Philadelphia just announced last week it will be closing 44. And more than two dozen other schools are supposed to be going through what they call a reformation, as it were. In Washington, D.C., where Mr. Obama, when he opens his window, can see right the district, smack in the middle of the district, 20 schools are to close. 23 were already closed. New York City, 22 closed this year. And since 2002, 142, yes, I said 142, shut down or phased out or in one way removed from service to the community since 2002. Newark, New Jersey, six closed already, and more to come. So, is it that only in our community is there a need for school closing? All these schools are being closed in black and Latino communities, and this country still remains relatively peaceful? And this president is allowed, on the practically the same day as they announce it, in his own home state, in his own home city, with his own former chief of staff, who is now the mayor of the city of Chicago. calling attention to the fact how strapped the city is. It needs money. Well, what was Barack Obama doing? He was on his way to deliver money, to deliver the assurance of money, to say to the state of Israel, you could count on us as a never-ending reservoir of money. We will fund your military. We will fund your excursions into and incursions into Palestine. We will fund all kinds of military initiatives that you have to kill children. And yes, we'll overlook the fact that our own children right here in the United States, their educations are being taken from them by this administration. And here's what's so repugnant. Barack Obama has as his education secretary, the secretary of education is himself in need of an education. Arne Duncan, the secretary of education, has just a bachelor's degree. You see, this is the thing that burns me up about this man. Your secretary of education has just a bachelor's degree. I told you some time ago that things were so tough in the United States that 15% of the people driving cabs have bachelor degrees. So in other words, we could have used a cab driver. And it is a consistent pattern of this president to put people who have no qualifications whatsoever in charge of critical services. Arne Duncan was the guy who came through the daily, that is to say, the corrupt Democratic machine of Chicago. And the corrupt Democratic machine of Chicago chose him to run Chicago's schools. And then he was snatched up again by Rahm Emanuel to do the same job, which he left in order to get a higher post with his bachelor's degree, by the way, in sociology, not even in education. But these things can happen when you are a white man in a white world. You could be secretary of education with a bachelor's degree in sociology. You could be secretary of state with no experience. Zero. You could be secretary of the treasury and have no experience in international finance. That's the standard that Barack Obama has. Arne Duncan comes out of a tradition, quote unquote, of charter schools. And suddenly there is this war declared against black children and Latino children and their schools and the teachers in the schools. All to facilitate the mass exodus of children from the public school system and into the charter school system, which is what they're pushing, the privatization of education. And as in everything that is experimental or inconsequential to the other America, they could afford to put black and Latino kids as the guinea pigs for such an experiment. So they're shutting down the schools. This is an act of war against our community and against our children. This is a serious problem. And every black and every Latino and every white person of conscience should be out there saying, this is not going to happen here in the United States. We're not going to allow this to happen and be quiet about it. You have children whose futures are being forfeited for lack, supposedly, of funds. And yet you can get on a plane and go to Israel and assure the Israeli government of what the congressional research report says is unprecedented and extraordinary assistance. Since World War II, I'm reading from its report. This is a report that is prepared for members of Congress and the Senate. Since World War II to date, the United States has provided Israel $115 billion in bilateral assistance. What do you mean bilateral? We don't get anything back. Bilateral is when you give and you get. Almost all U.S. bilateral aid to Israel is in the form of military assistance, although in the past, Israel also received significant economic assistance. According to the report, in 2007, the Bush administration and the Israeli government agreed to a 10-year, $30 billion military aid package that gradually will raise Israel's annual foreign military financing grant from a baseline of nearly $2.55 billion in fiscal year 2009 to approximately $3.1 billion for fiscal year 2013 through fiscal year 2018. For fiscal year 2013, the report says, the Obama administration is requesting $3.1 billion in foreign military financing to Israel. That's not all. $15 million for refugee resettlement. $99.8 million in joint U.S. Israeli co-development of missile defense, and more and more and more and more funds. As President Obama was leaving, the National Jewish Democratic Council took the time and effort to release a statement to its constituency. And I read, throughout his presidency, President Barack Obama has made strengthening the U.S.-Israel relationship a top foreign policy priority. His work to strengthen that relationship places him among Israel's strongest supporters ever. In fact, here's what they said. Obama provided Israel with the largest amount of American military aid in U.S. history. More than $3 billion a year to assist Israel's military to ensure it has the latest and most efficient technologies and weapons available. I'm reading from their statement, the National Jewish Democratic Council. $275 million in supplemental funding to develop the Iron Dome missile system. Additional funding for the Arrow and David sling missile systems. $650 million, double the amount spent by the Bush administration. I'm reading from their report verbatim. Obama restored Israel's qualitative military edge with advanced weaponry. And it goes on to describe all the military weapons and all the joint military exercises and so forth and so on to create Israel as an unquestioned and undisputed military presence in that region of the continent. I have no problem. But I have a problem when a president can do this to support warfare and then also declare war on Black and Latino children here in the United States. I've got a problem with that. I've got a big problem with that. And you're using these children as guinea pigs to populate another form of education that is genocidal in effect. And you're going to tell me you are a black man. You are out of your mind. And our community is quiet while the genocide is occurring. You're going to tell me this. Let me tell you something. And don't forget it. You heard it here. I said it before. I'm going to say it again. We are clear this is a genocidal attack against the educational futures of our children. And it wouldn't matter to me what race it is. But it matters to me that it is almost exclusively black and Latino. That bothers me. And it bothers me that this Congress continues. They're on vacation. They're resting up. The president had a great time. By the way, he did something else that was profoundly insulting. The president took rocks from the Martin Luther King Memorial to place on the graves of Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel who was assassinated, and Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism. Excuse me. This is the second insult he has done with respect to Martin Luther King. So Martin Luther King to this president is just symbolic. You can do anything with his memory. You don't have to know whether Martin Luther King would have approved. This is not important. Whoever his handlers are thought it was important, and he did their bidding. This is an unthinking president who hasn't a brain in his head. To understand that there are symbolisms that you must observe. There are things that matter to people. What is behind or what is going hand in glove with this attack, this genocidal attack against our communities? It is not just that they are emptying the schools. You know when you see this level of attack, where they're systematically emptying schools, you know hand in glove with that is a real estate issue. Every school that they take off the market will become immediately available to their friends in real estate as you see these communities being gentrified. Washington, D.C. being an example. The emptied schools suddenly became fashionable homes and lofts and luxury condos. Harlem, the same thing. Philadelphia, the same thing. Detroit, Newark, the same thing. Over a period of years, you systematically just write off these communities so that they just sink to a point of no return. And if they don't sink on their own, you encourage it. You accelerate it by causing it to sink to a point of no return, which they've done. And then the last thing you do now is you take away those last remaining institutions that create community, churches, schools, social service centers. You shut them down. When you reclaim 160 schools, that's a lot of acreage in a city that is undergoing fast and furious gentrification. Those who remain from the original communities will have to pay for it. They'll now have to find a way to send their children to private schools or give them up to the unquantified success of charter schools. In fact, I looked it up. Charter schools are not performing any better than public schools. Their rates of success are not as impressive as people would think. But it is that it affords a cozy relationship, a profitable relationship between the people who are well connected, and in Chicago and in New York and in all these other areas, there is incredible amounts of corruption. By the time they declare a school to be closed, real estate people already have plans for that. And since these are now going to be city properties, they will be, quote, auctioned off, unquote, to some private interest. And in no time, you're going to be walking down the street where a public school used to be, and you see a doorman, and you see trappings of very luxurious living in the same communities that nobody wanted to live in. So the city is, in fact, an agent of it. This is the president's secretary of education. This is the president's secretary of education, and it's okay by him. Probably because his two daughters have a very nice school that they go to in Washington, D.C., so these conditions and these things will not affect them. So he's not concerned about it. The offense. I was almost apoplectic last week when I saw this thing going on. I'm saying to myself, this man is out of his mind. This man truly is a puppet. He truly does not care. And I described our communities as being used as like booster rockets. Our job is only to get people into orbit. And once there, they don't care. They jettison you. They cut you off. They leave you to fall wherever you want to after the payload has been delivered to the required stratosphere, the height they wish to reach. And the cities in which this massacre is occurring, this educational massacre is occurring, they still remain governable. That is remarkable. So if your children are not worth fighting for, then what? Then what? You're going to balance a budget on the backs of children. And you're lying about it on top of that. And the little bit of money that could carry them through and the people that you could call on within the communities for help in any progressive idea that you have. You're not bothering to talk to anybody. You don't have to talk to anybody. You just look at a piece of paper and say, you know what, we're going to close this school and close that one and close that one. Great. So we know we have X number of billions of dollars of real estate in our hands, and we're going to share that with our pals. You think we don't know this? I'm trying to tell you, folks, this is not just about education. This is a real estate fight. To achieve it, it requires the shutting down, the closure of one of the most important elements in civilizing a society, schools. There are places on the planet now where the city of Chicago is no better off than remote areas of our planet. And yet you live in the superpower, the United States, the only superpower, the only one. As William Bloom told us last week. And this is what you do. But you can go. You can go with the confidence. And we know what that was all about. You go with confidence to show what a great superpower you are. Again, you're using Martin Luther King. Rather disgustingly, I would say. As if you had any love for Martin Luther King. But it was good to have a Bible to put your hand on. And now good to indicate how you identify with him. You're not even fit to shine his shoes. Our community is a joke if we sit down and let these things happen. There should be protest after protest in Washington, D.C., cutting this man off. Cutting him off of any access. You heard him with his wife out there now saying, this is what we all now have to do. Barack Obama isn't finished. He hasn't started. He has not started a program. And everything he is pushing has nothing to do with us. I told you the gun issue, oh, it's so hot. Nothing in the gun issue has anything to do with the black community. You haven't yet started a jobs program. You haven't done anything that we have identified to you as important, primary. But you have used our energy. You have used your own people's energy to catapult you, to maintain you, to protect you. And you see no reason to be loyal. Cut you off. And cut off the supply to the Democratic Party while you're at it. Punish this Democratic Party. Dismantle it. Destroy it. It is a destructive force in our community. It has no use for us. We should have no use for it. I'm going to calm down a little bit and go to the city of Chicago. A staff coordinator with the Chicago Teachers Union. Hello?
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And I'm speaking with Jackson, is it?
Yes.
Okay. What's your last name, Jackson?
Potter.
Jackson Potter, thank you so much. Well, we've been following the Chicago Teachers Union and what it's been through in the last several months. And you have a little problem, I hear.
Big problem.
Tell me about it.
Well, they, you know, the mayor has decided that he wants to close over 50 schools. The number goes up if you count turnarounds, which fire the whole staff, and you count co-locations where charters are being put in existing schools, to about 66 buildings that are impacted by these decisions. And it's a devastating policy that hasn't worked for the last 8 years that they've been doing it. It's displaced people. It's destabilized communities. It's put children in harm's way. It hasn't saved the district money. And it's really imperiled all kinds of community throughout Chicago. So we're very concerned.
What has been the CTU's response to date?
Well, it's been a long one. You know, since 2004, when the mayor announced the Renaissance 2010 program of closing 60 to 70 schools in a six-year period, you know, the union started off attempting to hope and pretend that this problem would go away and they could negotiate their way out of the issue. And slowly, there was a rank and file resistance that grew as people realized what this was doing to their school communities. And a huge parent and community coalition emerged, known as the grassroots education movement. And so the union, these last 2.5 years, has really played a central role in helping to merge all of our different efforts and fight what's been a tremendously unpopular policy to date.
Well, it is it's tremendously unpopular, but I tell you what we've been seeing, not just in Chicago, but in other cities where the same action has been taken. We don't see leadership at the political level. Mm-hmm. The people who are doing the grunt work, the people who are most impassioned about this, have been unions and parents and teachers. But I don't see that in the city halls, mm-hmm. and in the city councils, there is a throwdown fight over this.
Right.
Same thing in Chicago?
Well, we did see that in Philly, despite the fact that they closed 20-plus schools in that town. The city council voted unanimously against the closings. And we are starting to see a concern, unlike previous years, coming out of our politicians. So we saw the head of the Black and Latino Caucus in Springfield, our state capital, finally come out and say that they were going to support a moratorium on school closings initiative and attempt to get it out of committee and vote on it. We've seen record levels of aldermen coming out to hearings around the school closings, adamantly stating that they're opposed to any school closing and talking about the racist impact that it will have on their constituents. So there's a new found militants, and I think it has everything to do with the fact that there are very angry parents in these communities who see the handwriting on the wall, that their families are being pushed out of their homes, of their schools, of these institutions that are anchors to their neighborhood, and that overwhelmingly it's the Black community bearing the brunt of the damage. And so there is a wake-up call. To what extent it's going to lead into legislative action, hard to say. But, you know, when people don't feel like they're being heard, they have to start taking matters into their own hands.
One last question, Jackson. I know we pulled you out of a meeting. I'm so sorry. What is the immediate situation going to be with respect to the union and City Hall?
What are we going to do as
yes.
it relates to City Hall?
Yes.
Well, I think that this problem lies squarely on the shoulders of the mayor. You know, he's been going around town for months now saying that he needed 50 schools. It's kind of like the Vietnamization of school policy here, where body counts are the method by which they determine the success of their policies, rather than, you know, the benefits that are accruing to children. And that's a secondary, if at all, a consideration. And so we know that the mayor's the decision maker at the end of the day, that he's set this hit list out, the people he's appointed at the Chicago Board of Education. That's an appointed, undemocratic board. And ultimately, he's going to have to face the music of the anger and the tremendous devastation wrought by the policy. So we have every intention of continuing to call for him to do the right thing and be the Democratic mayor that he was elected to be and respond to his constituents and listen to their pain and suffering and try to address their concerns instead of steamrolling them, which has up to the present been his approach.
Thank you so much, and thank you all the more for allowing us to kind of bogart our way into your meeting and drag you out of it. But thank you so much for being with us today and giving us a snapshot of where things are in Chicago.
No, thank you for having us at any time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thanks. Did you hear that phrase? The body count. The mayor is interested in a body count, and they're referring to children. You heard him confirm, mostly the black community, and it is the case not just in Chicago, but all across the nation. They're targeting black folks, and we have an allegedly black president. Look, before I explode, let's take a break. When I come back, we'll continue learning a bit more about our managed president. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I hope you make this your station and the station of everybody in your circle. I'm Eutrice Lead. We're now joined by Phyllis Bennis, who directs the New Internationalism Project at the International Policy Institute. She's also a fellow at the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She's been a writer, analyst, and activist on Middle East and UN issues for many, many years. And she, in 2001, helped to found and remains on the steering committee of the U.S. campaign to end Israeli occupation. Hey, Phyllis, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Lutus.
Thanks a lot. Well, what do you make of the president's visit to Israel?
Well, this was a trip he probably had to make for political reasons, but it was in many ways a repeat of earlier positions that he took, most notably in 2010, when that summer he spent in what was described in the press as, you know, putting major pressure on Israel, when in fact what it amounted to at that time was a set of requests, please stop expanding settlements. The Israelis said no, and the requests stopped. Similarly, this time around, he goes to Israel, and for a hot second he goes off to the West Bank, and he gave a couple of rather extraordinary speeches. He has an incredibly good speechwriting team, and he urged young Israeli Jews to go over the heads of their leaders to change things. He talked about justice. He talked about the need to see, that he called on these young Israeli Jews to see the world through Palestinian eyes. It was really quite extraordinary. The problem was, before and after and during that, he made clear that the position of the United States is, we would like you to do these things, but if you don't, there is no consequence. You will continue to get the $30 billion in military aid that Israel is getting over these 10 years. We will begin to negotiate a new aid package, which will be even higher. We will escalate the amount of military aid we're sending specifically for these the Iron Dome anti-missile system. We will continue to defend you at the United Nations so that you will never actually be held accountable for potential violations. But in the meantime, we will urge justice. It was a rather extraordinary mix of more of the same in terms of policy, but a soaring amount of rhetoric that will have no consequences.
But not only that, the symbolism, I talked about it earlier, about using Martin Luther King as part of the necessary equipment to forge this dialogue that he...
There was a great deal of sort of rhetorical flourishes. Certainly the evocation of Dr. King's legacy, when in fact the U.S. support for Israeli militarism, Israeli occupation, directly violates exactly the three goals that Dr. King taught, that he said there are the three evils we must oppose: militarism, poverty, and racism. And the U.S. support for Israeli occupation and Israeli apartheid, of course, support all three of those evils rather than opposing them. The symbolism of the graves that he visited. He went to visit the grave of Yitzhak Rabin, a former Israeli prime minister, who was assassinated by a right-wing Israeli person in 1995. And is widely revered as this great peace representative, despite the fact that as defense minister just a few years before that, it had been Rabin, the peacemaker, who called on his troops publicly to break their bones, talking about the children of the Intifada, the first Intifada, the nonviolent Intifada, to break their bones if a child should throw a stone at a soldier. He went to the grave, and this was different, I think, than most U.S. presidents. He went to the grave of Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, and identified him as a great hero. It was ironic, given Herzl's own history, which I'm guessing, and I want to believe that Obama really didn't know this part of Herzl's history. Herzl wrote pleading letters to the infamous British colonialist Cecil Rhodes, urging him to come on board Herzl's Zionist project. And he wrote saying, I understand that your interest is Africa and mine is Arabia, but what we share is that we are both engaged in colonial projects, and I urge you to join with me. It's an astonishing thing. And I think that Obama, the man at least, if not Obama the president, has some understanding of the dangers and the horrors that colonialism in Africa brought to bear on the people of Africa. I wonder if he would have had any hesitation going to Herzl's grave and calling him out as a great hero if he had been aware of that wannabe link between Herzl and Cecil Rhodes.
Oh, we should point out Cecil Rhodes is the man who basically owned a little country called Rhodesia and now is Zimbabwe, of course.
The decolonization process.
What do you think? You referred earlier to the political reasons that Obama went there. What are those political reasons?
Well, Obama was looking at a scenario in which, in his second term, he was elected with support of powerful pro-Israel forces in the Jewish community and in the Christian community, more from the Jewish side, but with hesitation from all of those forces, that he was not sufficiently pro-Israel. He needed to prove his pro-Israeli credentials. And in that context, one of the accusations, as it were, was that he had not gone to Israel in his first term as president. He had, of course, visited Israel as a candidate, but he had not gone as president, and that was seen as a grave sin. So he was going through the motions of that. You know, it's the same reason that every president has to go to the AIPAC convention, et cetera. This year, President Obama actually didn't go to AIPAC, although he did go to others. But it was sort of a political necessity that had nothing to do with strategy, nothing to do with policy, because he had no new policy to announce. There was the sense, because he left Secretary of State John Kerry behind, that maybe there's the possibility of getting, quote, the peace talks are going to be underway again, as if we're supposed to be very excited that 21 years of failed diplomacy is about to become 22 years of failed diplomacy. But he left behind no indication of a new policy, no indication of any willingness to bring real pressure to bear on Israel to end its occupation or its apartheid policies, certainly no indication of a willingness to condition even any of the $30 billion of U.S. military aid to this 23rd wealthiest country in the world, any willingness to condition U.S. protection of Israel at the United Nations on an Israeli shift away from occupation, away from apartheid. So there was simply no new or renewal, even of old policy initiatives on this trip. This was solely for political reasons.
Well, I don't know why the pressure was on him or he felt compelled to do it. Ronald Reagan had never been. George Bush went, I think, in his second term. So I don't understand that there was this great pressure. But I also see that with regard to Netanyahu, he might have gotten something that he also could have used, which was a kind of breather from the criticism. He just managed, I understand, to scramble together a government and has been under unrelenting attack from the Israelis who want peace and see him as being ridiculously Zionist, very, very hawkish, very warlike, and dedicated to war. How did President Obama's visit help or hinder Netanyahu?
Well, I think that there certainly was a gain for Netanyahu, the chumminess that President Obama showed. Interestingly, I thought that Netanyahu, as the Prime Minister of Israel, actually had a more appropriate approach, which was a more formal approach. He spoke of Mr. President. For President Obama, he couldn't say Bibi enough times. It was Bibi this and Bibi that, Bibi and I, Bibi this, Bibi that, which I must say I found, aside from the politics of it, aside from the policy of it, aside from all of that, I found it incredibly distasteful, almost embarrassing, to see the U.S. president sort of groveling in that sense. So I think that there was something to be gained for Netanyahu. I think that one of the things that did emerge, and this, you know, it's a small thing, but perhaps the stakes are high, so perhaps it is important, that the question of Iran, at the end of the day, Bibi did not get what he wanted. He clearly wanted a recommitment of the U.S. to use force against Iran. And while President Obama did reiterate this language about all options remain on the table, he did not back down on the question of what are the red lines. The fact that there's any red lines, of course, is horrific. But there's a big difference between the Israeli and the U.S. red line. The Israeli red line arguably has already been passed. The Israeli red line is the idea of Iran's nuclear capability, which every country that produces its own enriched uranium for a peaceful nuclear power program has. It's the same technology. So Israel has, Iran, Israel, of course, has a nuclear weapon, not just the capability. It's the only country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons. Iran has the nuclear capability to build, as does any country with a uranium enrichment program. The problem is for Israel and the United States, that program is legal. And one of the things that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has said is, you know, all of this talk about where are the red lines is all irrelevant, because if Iran chose to move in that direction, we would know about it because they would have to kick out the UN inspectors. One of the things that President Obama did not say during his Middle East trip was to remind people what his own head of intelligence, General Clapper, had said in his testimony to Congress just a few days before President Obama arrived in Tel Aviv, where he said, what we determine, and this is the statement, the official position of the threat assessment of the entire United States intelligence community, all 16 intelligence agencies agreed, Iran does not have a nuclear weapon, Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, and Iran has not even made a decision about whether or not it will ever build a nuclear weapon. Given that, the notion that there is this urgency that, well, the window is closing for diplomacy, et cetera, simply has no basis in reality. But what was interesting was there was a sense from President Obama that he was telling Netanyahu, you've got to listen to me on Iran. I've got it. We're in charge. We're not going to let you down, but you should back off. At the same time, we're backing off on Palestine. So if you tell me that you're supporting a two-state solution, that's all I want to hear. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter how many new settlements you build. It doesn't matter how many Palestinians you assassinate. It doesn't matter any of that. It doesn't matter how much water you steal. None of that matters. All that matters is that you say the magic words, I support a two-state solution, whether or not a two-state solution is still viable. And most observers on the ground agree it is not. But aside from that, that's all that was required of him, was to say the magic words. So in a sense, there was almost a quid pro quo. The U.S. will stop pressuring Israel on Palestine if Israel will stop pressuring Obama on Iran.
Well, thank you so much, Phyllis. It's always enlightening to talk with you and to get a good fix on what's going on in that part of the world.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. Thank you. Well, I just wanted to wrap up today. I know we didn't have time for questions and comments. You can write me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com or on Facebook, facebook.com/leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories. I brought this to your attention today because this is intolerable, and there has to be a point at which we say it's enough. We cannot forgive any more transgressions by this president against poor people. We just can't forgive that anymore. We can't excuse it. We can't ignore it. We can't deny it. The man simply has no respect for our community. And as you heard from our discussion today with our guests, the fight essentially is being led by people, not legislators. So if they are not useful to you, make up your mind that they will have no further use to you. And find and construct a healthy alternative, and at this point, just about anything else looks better. This president is a very huge embarrassment. It's a humiliation to our aggregate interests and even to our notion of community. And you use people and their the price they paid for their good name. Martin Luther King, oh, he's just the symbolic stuff. Yeah, we put a little rock there. It looks good. They got the pictures of a humbled president using the name of a stellar citizen to accomplish a PR objective. How disgraceful. How disgraceful. We'll see each other tomorrow. Please tell your friends and pass the word around. PRN is where you need to be, and Lead Stories is absolutely where you need to be. See you tomorrow. Thanks.